King, or can you tell?
I can tell both here and when you cleared your throat.
Uh-huh.
So I'm going to start this by saying that this is the 29th of October, 2014, and I am interviewing Professor Kenneth G. Standing at the University of Manitoba in his office. And my name is Mike Grayson, and without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and start the interview and ask Ken a little bit about his background. Particularly, we're interested in the educational background, the attitude of his parents towards education and science. So I guess you could probably be good to let us know when you were born.
I was born on 3rd of April, 1925.
Okay. And you were born in what part of the country?
In Winnipeg.
Winnipeg. So you're
I'm a native.
You're a serious native.
Yeah.
You've probably seen Winnipeg change quite a bit over those many years.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right.
It has. And your parents' names?
I've written all this down. My father was E. Graham Standing, and my mother was Elsie M. Standing.
Uh-huh. And were you an only child, or were there other siblings?
No, there were four of us. They're all dead except me.
Oh.
I was the eldest, but I'm still alive.
You're the survivor.
Yeah.
It has sometimes, it's a good thing sometimes. Yeah, so good.
Yeah.
What did your father do for a living?
He was basically an accountant. He ended up as vice president of an outfit called National Drugs Limited, which was a wholesale druggist.
Okay.
In Winnipeg.
I see. So that was a fairly, a lot of people's background would have been in farming or cattle raising at this time. But even in Winnipeg, at this particular time, he had a more of a professional job than probably most of the people in the city.
He wasn't a professional, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
He was an accountant.
Okay.
Yeah.
I guess the population of Winnipeg was quite a bit smaller.
It was a fraction of what it is now.
Which today you're saying about 800,000 probably?
A few hundred thousand.
Okay.
Yeah.
And your mother, did she have any education in her background? Or?
She was a primary teacher. She taught grade one before she was married.
Uh-huh.
And then she became a housewife.
Uh-huh. So that was a standard thing, that if a woman teacher became married, she ceased teaching.
That's right.
Yeah. We're not sure why they did that. But
yeah, well, she had four children.
Well, that's one reason.
Very quickly.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And so did your father have any college education?
No, he got an honorary degree from the other university here, the University of Winnipeg.
Uh-huh.
He was very active in the United Church, and he got something called, I think it was Doctor of Sacred Letters
or something
like that.
I see.
Yeah.
So this was in recognition for his...
For his work
years.
For the church,
okay.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So his accounting background came from I assume he went to high school.
I went through school in Winnipeg, but, wait a minute. First of all, I had a maternal uncle who got an M.D. from Manitoba.
Oh, okay.
And a paternal uncle who was a teacher and finally principal, and he received a B.A. These were from the University of Manitoba.
Mm-hmm. So this represented a fairly well-educated group of people in your immediate family circle.
A reasonably well-educated group, yes. It wasn't, Well, I wasn't highly educated, but somewhat.
Well, I'm guessing that in general, though, I would be more highly educated than the general populace that would have.
Certainly so. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's, you know, the kind of point that we would like to draw out at this point. So,
but no scientific education, okay, sure, particularly.
Well, then, let's start with your education.
Okay, I
went to grade school somewhere.
Was educated entirely in public schools in Winnipeg, mm-hmm, to start with, and then as my siblings were,
mm-hmm,
and
were there any events in early education in grade school that
well,
had you missed in science?
I took I was educated in Winnipeg public schools, ending up in something called DMCI, which was Daniel McIntyre Collegiate Institute,
okay,
so on, which was high school.
How do you spell McIntyre in this case?
MC capital INTYRE, I think.
Okay. Okay. You gotta check that one.
So I was educated in these public schools in Winnipeg, and I've ended up in grade 11 being selected to write for a scholarship.
Okay.
Which I was successful in receiving.
All right. This is, I mean, Canada is a British, is related to Britain, okay?
yeah, originally, yeah, anyway.
And you know, in the British system, you get to a certain point in your education and you're given an exam that divides you into, as Ray March said, divides you into the washed and the unwashed.
Yeah, there's nothing like that in Canada, in Winnipeg,
okay,
at least.
So that's educational.
Well, there was certainly some segregation, mm-hmm, of students, and I was in the top class in high school.
So they did recognize academic performance and tried to enhance that by ensuring that you got a more rigorous education.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
And particularly since I was chosen to write for a scholarship, we had a special program in geometry that one gentleman gave, which was very useful, actually.
So this was geometry. Why was geometry the chosen for this?
Well, because I had taken geometry in grade 10,
uh-huh,
and this was the end of grade 11.
Okay.
So it was thought advisable to brush up people on geometry.
Hmm. Okay.
And this was quite useful, actually.
Hmm. Interesting.
I ended up getting 100.
No. Okay. You knew your geometry pretty well.
That's right. That's right.
Well, it's a very good course for logic, logical thinking.
Yes.
And it's kind of better, different than algebra for sure, and trig, but it is really...
Yeah, well, I took algebra and trig as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This was in high school.
In high school. I still have the books.
Mm-hmm. Well, some things don't change a lot.
That's right.
So you wrote for the scholarship, which I assume you ended up winning.
Sorry?
You wrote for the scholarship?
Yes, for my so-called junior matriculation at the end of grade 11.
Okay. And you won the scholarship?
There were four senior scholarships. Available in Winnipeg, and four junior ones.
I see.
And I got one of the senior ones.
And so what did that get you?
That gave me a certain amount of money. It's laughable in present standards. I think it was $150.
Oh, wow.
And it was expected that I would use it in university.
Yeah. Pretty amazing. So this also probably made it easier for you to get into the university.
Yeah, although there was no problem then. It was anybody could get in. Mm-hmm. Whether you could pass or not was another question.
Okay. So this university would have been University of Manitoba?
University of Manitoba,
okay.
Yeah.
Which you said there was another university in town?
Yeah, was originally a college of the University of Manitoba, and now it's a separate university, University of Winnipeg.
Okay. So you did have a choice between those two schools?
I could have taken classes at the college, yeah. But I chose to take classes at the university proper.
Okay. And what was the... that would have been in
1943. Let's see, I've written this down. That was 1943-4. I took what was then second year and now is first year, University of Manitoba.
And how large was the university at that time? Was it?
How large was it? Oh, a couple thousand students, I think.
Okay, and I guess since...
2,000.
Okay, since Winnipeg is the provincial capital, I guess that made it a town that would have more than one college or, you know, school.
Well... Yeah, the originally it was just one university, and the University of Winnipeg was then a college.
Okay.
And when we came in here, we passed various colleges that are still connected to the university.
Okay. So you had a regular four-year university?
Well, no, I took 1 year. To start with, and I was a member of the University Naval Training Division,
okay.
UNTD, at that time.
And the war was going on.
The war was going on. That was, and so I went on active service at the end of that year.
Which took you to where?
Pardon?
Where did you serve?
I served in Halifax and Shelburne. Never saw action.
Shelburne, S-H-S-E-H-E-L.
S-H-E-L-B-U-R-N-E.
Okay. So what did you do there at Halifax? And
I was a stoker first class.
Okay.
And I cleaned boilers.
Oh boy.
You climb into the boiler and you have a steel brush and you brush off the rust, etc. that's in the boiler.
So you want to get that, that would be an insulating coating, and you want to get that out of there. So
that's right, that's right.
So that was your whole contribution to the war. Was
I was originally cleaning boilers in Halifax, and then I was sent to Shelburne and again put on cleaning boilers. And finally, though, at Shelburne, I was sent out to a water pumping station that pumped the water to the base. And that was pleasant. There was a sign at the end of the little jetty that said absolutely no swimming, and next to it was a diving board. It was at a little lake called Rodney Lake.
How do you spell it?
R-O-D-N-E-Y.
Rodney Lake.
Yeah.
And
which is still in existence and is now the source of the town of Shelburne's water supply, I believe.
Oh, I see.
I visited it much, much later, a few years ago.
So Halifax is in what province?
In Nova Scotia.
Nova Scotia, okay. So that moved you to the west, east coast, right?
East coast, yeah. I was moved, first of all, to Halifax.
So
which was the place that where the convoys were assembled.
Okay.
Big harbor.
So were these convoys like protecting shipping?
Yeah, they were convoys that were protected against the German submarines.
Okay. There was an interesting article in a newspaper, I heard it somewhere, that they just discovered a German submarine in a couple hundred miles off the American coast in 600 feet of water.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, well, there was, at the time of the surrender, which was in 1945, when I was still in Shelburne, there was a submarine that came into Shelburne and surrendered there.
That's interesting. So that would have been a pretty dramatic event.
Pardon?
That would have been a very dramatic event to have this German
It was
stuff.
Fairly dramatic, although of course not as dramatic as it would have been a year or two earlier. It was after the cessation of hostilities in Europe.
So did you do anything else besides, what did you do at the water station? You just managed the water pumping?
Well, managed the pumping.
Okay.
Yeah. There were a number of us that managed the pumping there, I think four of us. And we had a little shack there that we lived in, and we were in charge of the pumping system.
Was there some fear that, that the pumping system could be damaged by
enemy action?
Yeah.
Well, not that I was aware of.
But they wanted to make sure that there was potable water.
Yeah, there was a big tank halfway along between us and the base. We were several miles from the base, and there was this big tank, which was a storage tank that was up on stilts, and we were responsible for keeping that full, more or less. And we got food. We did our own cooking.
So you were essentially
at arm's length from the base.
Everything else, and you stayed there.
Yeah, we stayed there.
The group stayed. Wow, okay.
Yeah. It was quite pleasant, actually. Yeah.
And so once the war is over, then what did that in your...
Then I returned to Winnipeg, and very fortunately, it turned out that I went on active service in 1944, and I got out in 1945 in time to go back to university.
Uh-huh.
So I only missed 1 year.
Oh, excellent. So was it difficult to start back into an academic environment after kind of being...
That's right. I returned to the University of Manitoba and took honors maths and physics, mm-hmm. which was the highest ranking physics that you could take at that time.
Mm-hmm. So that was more of a challenge than just taking the normal math and physics.
That was a challenge, yeah. At that time, it was a combination. You took several honors courses, and you took the general program as well.
Mm-hmm. So you had to work hard there?
Work hard. And at the end of it, I worked hard enough that I was accepted at Princeton.
Okay. So I'd like to back up a little bit. Obviously, you had an interest in math and science.
That's right.
And when did you realize that that was of interest to you? Was that like...
Well, I guess the idea is that you developed a tremendous interest in science early on, mm-hmm. but I think I dropped courses until all I had left was math and physics.
So it's just that you had an inclination towards math, towards the sciences.
Yeah, I certainly had an inclination towards science, but no tremendous impetus. I had a Meccano set, which is the equivalent of a Rector, is it?
Mm-hmm, the Rector set.
Yeah, and did that at home,
mm-hmm.
and I did the usual sort of thing, shorted out the electrical supply and so on.
Did you do any chemical experiments in that period?
Not really. As part of this program in honors maths and physics, I took some chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
I took a couple of courses in chemistry, ending up with a course in organic chemistry. I still have the book up there.
Uh-huh.
Conant.
Mm-hmm.
So I did take some chemistry, but mainly math and physics.
Okay. So basically, it's your own interest evolved into math and science. There wasn't some exterior mentor or some other person?
Nothing very dramatic.
Okay, just an evolution.
Yeah, evolution. I took math and physics, and then I remember the professor of mathematics, when I asked him for a reference and said I was going to Princeton, or hoping to go to Princeton, he asked whether I was going in math or in physics.
Uh-huh.
And I said in physics.
He didn't care for that. He wanted you to go for math.
Well, Princeton was very well endowed in both math and physics.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I went to Princeton because my old friend Doug Milton, who had gone through school with me from grade 3 on, had gone to Princeton a year ahead of me.
So he didn't have the year off for service.
He didn't have a year off for service.
Okay.
Yeah.
So your grades at the University of Manitoba were obviously pretty good.
Were good enough.
Yes. So what did it cost to go to the university then? How much?
Well, I was fortunate that after my active service, there was something set up by the Canadian government called the DVA, Department of Veterans Affairs, and they paid me so much a month and also paid my fees.
Oh.
All the time I was at Manitoba and for a few years at Princeton.
So this was a pretty sweet deal for your 1 year of service.
That's right.
So they essentially paid for your college expenses.
That's right.
And gave you a stipend to live on.
And still, they pay for, they give me a pension.
Oh, my. Okay.
Which is... couple hundred dollars a month, I think.
Well, that's...
Something like that. Now, on the assumption that my loss of hearing was due to something that happened in my...
During the war.
During the war. Which is really stretching it, of course.
Uh-huh.
But they paid for the hearing aids,
uh-huh.
And they pay me a pension.
And
so it was a sweet deal,
yeah,
as you say.
They paid for your education and gave you some to live on.
That's right.
So it worked well for your year of...
It was very worthwhile.
Cleaning boilers.
Yeah, it paid for cleaning boilers.
You did serve. I mean, you were enrolled as in the Naval Corps before you.
I was involved in the university.
Yeah.
Naval Training Division.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was that a choice that you made?
It was a choice I made.
Okay.
Yeah. A lot of my friends were in the forces and. I guess I felt that I should contribute as well.
So they were in the hotter part of the war, you could say.
Yeah, I could have stayed at university.
Sure. Well, I mean, your buddy Milton did, right?
But I decided to enlist.
Okay.
To go on active service.
Okay, very good. And... So we never really got to how much it cost to attend the University of Manitoba back then.
It cost, I've forgotten, a very small amount. It cost $150 a year or something for fees.
Oh, wow.
And I was living at home.
Okay.
So I had lots of money.
You were in good shape.
I was in good shape.
Okay. So you could save up, and you decided... You wanted to go to graduate school. Was that your own personal decision, or was that something that came about through mentors or through...
That was my own personal decision, and I went to Princeton because this old friend of mine had gone the year before.
And did you apply to any other schools?
I think it ended up that I was only applying to Princeton.
Okay.
Which was, in retrospect, very foolish.
Yeah, well, you know, at that age,
since even then, something less than 10% were accepted.
Uh-huh. So you must have had pretty good credentials coming out of the university.
Well, I think very largely it was because of Doug, who had gone there a year ahead, and he'd been successful, I think. And so I then followed in his footsteps.
So I'm kind of curious, since it's an American university, I wonder if they had a program for particularly accepting students from outside of the United States. Because as a Canadian citizen, I mean, you are a Canadian citizen.
Yes.
So
they were very broad-minded.
So when did you land in Princeton?
I landed in Princeton in the end of summer 48, I guess. No. Wait a minute. Yeah, 48.
Okay. And how did you find
it? I've written these things down.
Sure, yeah.
Because I find it hard to remember.
How did you find the campus then? This would have been immediately post-war.
Well, I was offered a job for the summer, so I went down for the first summer before classes started, actually.
Uh-huh.
And worked for a guy by the name of Ruby Scherr.
How do you spell it?
R-U-B-B-Y.
Two B's.
Yeah, two B's. S-H-E-R-R.
Okay.
Who was involved in the nuclear physics program there. They had a cyclotron.
Uh-huh.
And Ruby was one of the active people in it.
Uh-huh.
And the first summer I did, let's see, what did I do?
It wasn't cleaning.
Yeah,
well.
I worked on a possible use of radioactive uranium isotopes for scintillation counting.
Okay.
Was unsuccessful. I think at that time the summer options were just for ideas that somebody had, you know, to throw it out. So I worked for the summer for Ruby, trying to develop this, which I think impressed him because I could read French from the Canadian background.
So now let's talk about that French business.
Yeah.
So you, Winnipeg, I guess, was primarily French-speaking, or?
No, there's an area of Winnipeg that's primarily French-speaking.
I see.
Saint Boniface or Saint Boniface.
Uh-huh.
But it was normal to take courses in French all the way through high school, and in fact I took French in second year,
okay.
Which was the first year of university.
So you were the facile in the language?
I was, well, I could read it.
Uh-huh.
I wasn't very good at speaking.
Well, that's an advantage, though, being able to read. Particularly when you're coming into a scientific career, to read a foreign language.
Yes. Yes. So, anyway, that I think impressed Ruby, and because I had to read up about these uranium isotopes that most of the work had been done in France on them. So I worked that summer for Ruby, and I worked the next summer for Milt White, who was head of the cyclotron lab, and that was on a fast cycling cloud chamber.
Hey, what kind of cloud chamber?
Fast cycling. Yeah. Didn't work.
So your scintillation experiment didn't work.
That's right.
And your fast cycling cloud chamber didn't work.
That's right. Yeah.
Pretty well.
Yeah. And then I, at that time, and I think still, you had to write a so-called general exam, which was all of physics.
Yes.
They could ask you anything you wanted.
Yes.
And that was, I wrote that in 1950 and passed it.
So was that then, a day-long affair or multi-day or...
Sorry?
Was that a day-long exam?
It was multi-day, several days. I can't remember exactly how many days, 3 days or something like that.
So it was a fairly...
Fairly rigorous exam. Rigorous. Okay. I don't think I did very well at it. but I passed it anyway. And at that time, around that time, there was a big fire in the Princeton cyclotron. It went up in flames because there was it was cooled by oil tanks. The coils were cooled, and a friend of mine was one of the last people to use it. Anyway, when we called him Burner Peel, and he, anyway, it was effectively destroyed apart from the magnet, and so they had to rebuild it, which they did.
So I want to ask a little bit about the uranium isotope experiment. Was there, at that time, enough information to understand the dangers of the radioactivity from working with uranium?
I don't think we ever worried about that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. A few years later, I was... they had pricked... They pricked your finger and tested your blood once a month or something or other. And I was tagged as somebody who was at risk. And so they sent me into the outfit in New York that's Cancer Institute, and what I one thing I remember is carrying a big jar, which was a 24-hour output of urine.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, they couldn't find anything wrong with me.
Very good, but there was some concern after the fact.
There was some concern after the fact. They had instituted this monthly blood test. So there was some concern, but those of us who were presumably exposed didn't worry too much about it.
Okay, well, because, I mean, there's some... probably some fairly hot radiation coming off of uranium.
There was lots of radiation in the cyclotron, and thinking of it now, I mean, I changed the filament on the ion source and so on, and it was probably pretty hot, but no
No ill effects.
No ill effects as far as I could tell. Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about this fast cycling cloud chamber. What was the idea behind that?
That was a, you know, most cloud chambers are sort of like this. And the fast cycling chamber was a very narrow
volume
that had an electrode at the bottom that went up and down like this. And this was to produce the expansion, which you need in cloud chambers. As I say, it didn't work. I was never made able to make it work, let's put it that way.
So this would be to improve the amount of data that you could get from observing collisions?
Yes. That's right. The idea was that the beam from the cyclotron or another cosmic rays would come in along the axis, and you have an expansion, and then you could see the track. That was the idea.
It didn't work, though. Okay.
Didn't work.
So, what did you do your first year there after your first?
After I did the general exams in 1950, that was sort of the license to do a thesis. And at that time, Ruby, because the cyclotron was being rebuilt, had gone to Caltech for the year.
Okay.
I think it was Caltech.
Uh-huh.
And so I was more or less on my own.
Okay. So I guess I was curious how many cyclotrons were around in that time period. There probably weren't too many.
Oh, there were sort of half a dozen in the U.S.
Oh, okay.
Very few.
All right. And they were basically, I guess, with the war just ending, more and more schools wanted to get into.
Yeah, I think the Princeton cyclotron was used during the war to do various experiments. Anyway, when it burned, they decided to rebuild it, and it was rebuilt. But in that time, Ruby Scherr, who was my advisor, went away to Caltech.
Yeah.
So he said much later, in fact, at his 100th birthday party last year. He didn't survive to 100. He died in between 99 and 100. But anyway, he had a birthday party, and he said at that time that I was the most innovative graduate student he'd had.
Okay. And why did he characterize you that way?
Well, I think because he went off to Caltech, and I still did a thesis or two theses when he was gone. So
you had to come up with your own research plan.
I had come up with my own research plan, and the first one I came up with was double beta decay.
Okay.
With emission of zero neutrinos. That is, the neutrino is emitted in the first one and absorbed in the second decay.
Oh my.
In other words, it's a Majorana particle.
A imaginary?
Maj, M-A-J-O-R-A-N-A.
Majorana. Oh.
Majorana was an Italian physicist who had hypothesized this process.
Okay, so this was a theoretical construct.
Well, this was to try to find these double beta decays. There had been a guy named Ed Fireman at Princeton.
F-I-R-E-M-A-N.
Who had set an upper or a limit on the lifetime of this process, which was something like 10 to the 17th years.
10 to the
17th.
Wow.
Years. And he had detected a certain number of particles in a counter experiment and later on in a cloud chamber. And the idea was that I would measure this process. And it got far enough along that I had the iron for the magnet, for a magnet that I was using was cast, but not the
bull faces,
not the coils or the vacuum chamber. And at that time it was the it was scuppered by, in that case, by Milt White, who was sort of in charge of me since Ruby was away. And the idea was that there had been other experiments done that set higher limits, and it wasn't clear that my technique was going to be able to measure it. So that was the first thesis. That was double beta decay.
That was kind of esoteric, but you had a theoretical construct that permitted you to devise an experiment.
I did the. I was trying to do the experiment to detect this process.
So what was your source of beta?
What?
What was the source of your beta rays, beta particles?
Well, I was using a magnet that was cylindrically symmetric, but the idea was that the particles would follow so-called trochoidal orbits.
Yeah.
T-R-O-C-H-O-I-D-A-L.
Right.
Which had been studied again in France.
Okay.
By a guy named Thibaud, T-H-I-B-A-U-D, and he'd published a paper in it back in 1934. And the nice thing about it was that this was in the fringing field of the magnet, so the positrons would go one way and ordinary electrons would go the other way. And so one of the processes that was thought to produce background for this was internal pair production, a positron and a negatron. And so this was able to distinguish clearly between them, but didn't have high enough efficiency according to... I think it was correct because the problem still isn't completely satisfied. This is what, 48, uh-huh. 50. This is 60 years on.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it turned out to be a difficult problem. Mm. So it was a good idea to discover it.
Uh-huh.
So then I went on to do an experiment on the cyclotron that was working by that time.
So I assume that when they rebuilt the cyclotron, it was up to the highest standards and with the greatest, latest and greatest that you could have at the time, technology-wise.
It was... it worked better than it ever had before, and it was 50 MeV cyclotron.
Oh, okay. So this puts you in a different category with regard to cyclotrons around the country?
Yeah, it was competitive, I'd say, at that time.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Anyway, I started on a second thesis,
uh-huh.
This time coupled to the cyclotron pretty directly, on PD reactions in nitrogen.
What was that? P?
P, comma, D. D for deuteron.
Okay. PD reactions.
In nitrogen 14.
Okay.
And various other things, but my thesis was on nitrogen 14.
Okay. And there was a choice. Why did you choose nitrogen 14?
Well, there was some difficulties with previous measurements on nitrogen 14. Let's see, the Al Bromley, who went on to be the presidential advisor, I think, had done an experiment at Rochester on carbon 13 DN, I think, nitrogen 14. And there were some contradictions in between his experiment and another experiment. I can't remember what it was. And the difficulty in doing PD reactions was that they had an appreciable negative Q. In other words, you put in relatively high energy protons and you got deuterons out at much lower energy.
Uh-huh.
So that was that made it difficult because there were lots of background down at lower energy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So the PD reaction was more difficult than the DP reaction because of this Q value.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, it was one of the first PD reactions that were done, and it confirmed Bromley's measurement on the parity, so-called, of nitrogen 14.
Uh-huh.
And I was able to fit the so-called reduced widths, which were the measurement of the probability, to calculations by Tony Lane, I think.
Tony.
L-A-N-E. That's easy.
So that was your second?
That was my second thesis.
Okay.
And that was successful. I made the measurements, but I took a job as assistant professor back here at the University of Manitoba it's hard to feel atmosphere at that time. Now, of course, it's very competitive.
Uh-huh.
And when you advertise a job, you get all kinds of applications. At that stage, it was mainly, yeah, he's warm, we'll hire him. So they were, I think, overjoyed at the prospect of getting me onto staff. And I'd taken this job. But unfortunately, I took the job expecting to have the thesis all written up, and it wasn't.
Uh-huh.
I'd finished the experiment, but I hadn't written the thesis up.
Uh-huh.
So I went off to Manitoba at that stage as a staff member.
On the faculty.
Assistant professor, I think.
In 1950.
53, I think. 53. And that was a big mistake because I hadn't finished writing the thesis up.
Yeah.
But I worked very diligently for the next year or two and finally got it written up by 1955, by which time Ruby had got back to Manitoba, to Princeton.
Oh. So he spent several years away.
He spent, I think, just maybe a year. Maybe he got back at the end of 1953 when I left.
Ah, okay.
And, but he was back in time to read the thesis.
Uh-huh.
And I...
But you hadn't written up the... When did you write it up? When did you write up the thesis?
I wrote up the experiment that I'd done.
Uh-huh. But that, you hadn't submitted a dissertation.
What?
You hadn't submitted a dissertation.
Yeah, I submitted the dissertation on the experiment that I'd done. But of course you had to write that up, and I think it's still here. It's one of these books there. Anyway, by that time Ruby had got back, and he was able to read my thesis.
Okay.
Where he, at that stage, was quite ignorant of the process. What was a PD reaction?
Oh, okay.
But anyway, he read the thesis, and I went and took my final oral exam in 1955.
Okay.
And was granted the PhD degree from Princeton.
But you had already started at Manitoba.
I'd already started. I'd been 2 years teaching at Manitoba,
Okay. But you're, so finally, by the end of 1955, you're official.
I was officially an assistant professor before that, but it was sort of understood that I would get a PhD, and I did in 1955, 2 years later.
So is there any reason why you decided to just come back to Manitoba without having completed your...
Well, I guess the reason was basically a personal one. I was tied up with a girl in Winnipeg.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Now the truth comes out.
Romantic, yeah.
Okay. So you wanted to get back to your girlfriend.
Well, that's right.
Very good. So, but Winnipeg, the university here at Manitoba, was willing to go along with the idea that eventually you would get a PhD, you'd get your official.
Yeah, they were hard up. They didn't have much choice in the matter.
Okay.
But, of course, they, if it had gone on for years and years,
yeah,
they would have been kind of disturbed.
Yes, yeah. Well, a couple of years isn't too bad, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's better to get it all done.
That's right.
So I assume when you came back to Winnipeg, you got married?
Well, I started an experiment to do... I had an excellent student named Jovanovic. Jovanovich.
Okay. So you were at a research program.
Yeah, I started a research program at that time as well as teaching. Which was a very heavy teaching load.
Yeah,
normal at that time.
How many contact hours did you have back then?
I guess I was teaching three or four courses. I'm not quite sure how many contact hours that amounted to, but two lectures per week in each of these courses, I think.
Yeah. This would have been like introductory physics and then maybe some higher level courses?
It was introductory physics was one, and I had a graduate course in nuclear physics and a course in, I think, E&M or something like that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So that would have kept you pretty busy in class.
Yeah, it kept me busy. But with Jovan, I started an experiment on gamma ray scattering. Where we used a multi-Curie source, a cobalt-60 source that was up at the Health Sciences Lab. They used it normally for irradiations.
Yeah, cobalt-60 is kind of hot, isn't it?
It's 1.33 MeV and then there's a smaller gamma ray as well.
Yes.
Anyway, we did measured scattering, which was a hard experiment
for gamma rays.
Yeah, for gamma rays.
Yeah. Well, they're probably.
We were looking for so-called Delbruck scattering.
Delbruck?
Delbruck, D-E-L-B-R-U-C-K.
Oh, okay.
Named after a man who was then at Caltech.
Okay.
And that was scattering from the electric field, essentially.
Oh, okay.
But we set an upper limit on that, which was better than anybody else had done.
Okay.
And anyway, we did this gamma ray scattering experiment.
And the gamma ray, the cobalt-60 source, was located in?
Up in the Health Sciences Lab.
Okay.
One of the peculiar things about the University of Manitoba is that there are two campuses. There's this campus, which is the main campus, and there's the Health Sciences that's up by one of the hospitals, about 20 minutes away by car. So anyway, this was up at the in a shielded room at the Health Sciences campus. And they used it normally during the daytime. They used it for irradiating tumors. We had it overnight.
Oh, wow, okay.
So that was some difficulty.
Yes. Because basically you would have an experiment to set up and run.
We had the... we had it on a cart, and we moved it out in front of the beam, and we were outside the shielding wall. There was a shielding wall, and we were outside the shielding wall and pressed a button to start the to open the shutter and start the beam going for. Our targets were fairly large things, about this big.
Like maybe 6 to 8 inches on a side?
Pardon?
6 to 8 inches on a side, the target?
Yeah, 6 inches, 6 by 6 maybe, something like that.
Okay.
And we did basically on lead.
Lead.
So that was a successful experiment.
Okay.
We published in, first of all, in Nature and then in the Canadian Journal of Physics.
So, yeah, it's usually getting in Nature is considered to be a feather in your cap, except just anybody's.
That's right.
Work.
And the guy who the theorist, Jerry Brown, who was gave a talk saying how great the experiment was.
So this helped the theoreticians in their development of the theory.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's people. A number of people had done experiments before that, I guess, you might say, weren't very good.
Okay. And you had managed to do the best measurement.
We did it better. Yeah.
So this gentleman Jovanovich was he was doctoral student.
He got a master's degree from this, and then he went off to Washington University in St. Louis.
Oh, okay. Well. Yeah, I know they had a cyclotron there.
Well, they had. I think it's now the lab that is the mass spec lab.
Mike Gross has. Yeah, where he used to work.
Yeah.
Yeah, they still call it the cyclotron building.
It could be. It could be.
But I think back when in the 50s having a cyclotron on campus was a kind of a premier kind of thing.
It was a prestige item,
yeah.
Anyway, he went on and did various things at Washington U, and then went on to Brookhaven, etc., etc. Okay, in the meantime, I went off to University of Bristol. I had a sabbatical, I think, coming up, and I went to University of Bristol 58-59, and
Where is Bristol?
Bristol's in England.
Okay, that's what I was thinking.
What?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. You went abroad for...
Yeah, that's right. So I went to... If you looked at my CV, I had some sort of distinction at University of Bristol. I had a Nuffield Fellowship at University of Bristol.
How do you spell that?
N-U-F-F IELD.
Nuffield Scholarship. Very good.
Lord Nuffield was the big, made cars.
Ah, okay.
Morris Minor and so on. And but he'd established a certain fund that, among other things, supported me while I was at Bristol.
That's good. I want to back up a second, though, just for a while, to Princeton. there's a number of people who were in the mass spec game at Princeton, and I think they were all in the physics department. Did you interact with any of those?
No, by that time they'd moved on. There was... Luby, the guy I worked for, had done his original experiment on what you might call mass spectrometry back in the 30s.
Okay.
And let's see, I think...
I'm trying to think of this one fellow who is had an ion source. It was probably instrumental in the development of the electron impact ion source, but I can't think of his name off the top of my head right now. But
yeah, I may think. Anyway, by the time that I arrived. It was during the war, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
The fellow who had been mainly concerned with mass spectrometry was doing shockwaves.
Oh, okay.
And it, I think the other development at Princeton was a great big ring. That was, but again, that had died by the time I arrived. So there was no mass spectrometry in Princeton.
Okay, I was just kind of curious because.
Yeah, there had been in the 30s.
Yeah, I know one of the graduate students that got out of Minnesota went to Princeton, and I can see a picture of him in my brain, but I can't think of his name.
Tate?
No, Tate stayed at Minnesota. It was one of his students who measured the ionization levels at mercury and essentially created what is now the grandfather of electron impact ion source.
Yeah. There was, of course, the a very eminent physicist who worked in the Manhattan Project, who was at Minnesota, near.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Near.
Yeah. Yeah. No, this would have been, I think this guy got out of Minnesota just before near. I'll figure it out.
All right. Well, anyway, I didn't have any contact with them, and I had contact with near much later on.
Sure.
I met him at a meeting.
Yeah.
Anyway, coming back to Bristol, I was involved in one of the first experiments on gamma ray astronomy.
Oh, okay.
And that was unsuccessful.
You have a pretty good record here.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the idea would be to detect gamma rays from...
Yeah, that's right. We sent up a lead sphere that was about this big, and a counter inside it, and a movable shutter that went around. And the results were sent down by telemetry.
Okay.
This so we cooperated with the people from Aldermaston.
Okay.
The weapons lab.
Sure.
who were anxious to do something useful.
Yeah. This was a balloon experiment, I guess?
This was a well, most of the experiments that were being carried out then were balloon experiments.
Right.
They sent big chunks of emulsion up by balloon. And the Bristol lab was famous because Powell had discovered the Pi Meson, I think.
Oh, okay. Pi Meson?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, the Bristol lab was famous for studying cosmic rays.
I see.
But I started this offshoot, which was gamma ray astronomy, which wasn't successful when I was there, at least. It was somewhat successful later on, and very successful in people who did things by satellites.
So do you think perhaps that you needed to get to a higher altitude in order for it to work?
Well, I think the lab in Bristol wasn't very well set up to do this sort of experiment, really. So that was interesting.
So you were hoping to find
Gamma rays from the Crab Nebula, I think.
Okay, and so from far away, not particularly close by.
That's right.
Okay. And you had a lead sphere with detector inside of it?
It was a detector inside a lead sphere and with a shutter going back and forth in front of the thing. And we didn't detect any appreciable difference.
Oh, okay. So you're looking for a change in radiation as a...
That's right.
Position.
We were looking for, if there'd been a... We were pointing... You could point this because it was on a balloon. And you could point this at the Crab Nebula, and you could then put the shutter in front and not in front of the aperture and measure to see if there's any difference.
Okay.
And there wasn't any difference.
Very good.
Since then, gamma ray astronomy has got to be a big deal, but not then.
So were you one of the first persons to try and do this gamma ray measurement?
We were one of the first, anyway. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. They they started X-ray astronomy. And that was, it turned out, quite successful. So anyway, that was...
So you stayed there for a year?
In 58, 59. Okay. Yeah, stayed there for a year. And at that stage, they decided to build a cyclotron at Manitoba.
Okay, they wanted to get in the cyclotron game.
That's right, another cyclotron, and brought me back to be in charge of building it, which I was foolish enough to do at the time. I could have got a job at Bristol, actually.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah.
At the university there?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but I chose to come back to Winnipeg to build the cyclotron.
So and this sounds like it was a challenge.
Well, it was a challenge. We there had been the head of the department had been talked into the fact that it was you could build a cyclotron fairly cheaply.
Oh.
And modeling after one at UCLA.
So, who was the talker that convinced him about this cheap cyclotron construction?
Well, this was Whitmore, who was chairman of the department at the time. And he'd gone down and visited the people at UCLA.
He wanted one.
What?
He wanted one.
He wanted one. Because people here, there had been a number of people who had been working with radioactive isotopes of one kind or another.
Yeah.
And they had the idea that it would be useful to have a cyclotron to make isotopes.
Right.
Radioactive isotopes.
Yes, of course, sure.
And the idea was that this cyclotron would be patterned after the one at UCLA, and in fact it was, except it used a if you want to change the magnetic field in a cyclotron, generally speaking, people used, these were sector field machines. So they had sectors, hills and valleys. And in the valleys, people tended to put in coils to change them, to regulate the magnetic field. And we did something unusual. We used Invar blocks that were controlled in temperature. So you went through the Curie point, where above the Curie point, there was no magnetism. Below the Curie point, there was.
Yeah.
So this was the interesting, if you like, of variation that we used on the UCLA machine. So anyway, we built this, and it worked.
It worked this time.
Yeah, it worked.
It sounds like it was not that easy to put together or get it done.
It was. It took some time to put together, and we had a conference finally after it started to work in 65. And one thing that was important for succeeding things was that Ron McFarlane came. He was then at McMaster, and he attended this conference that we had to commemorate the working of the cyclotron. So he was a nuclear chemist at McMaster, and before he moved to Texas, and he attended this meeting, and I met him at that time. So that was important for succeeding measurements or succeeding developments.
So were there, it sounds like there might have been some cost overruns associated with building the cyclotron.
Well, yeah, I guess it was cost overruns, but we kept being supported by the Atomic Energy Control Board of Canada that had quite a lot of money at the time.
So, did the school put in any money, or was this money for the cyclotron all from the government?
All from the government, I think. I think there was maybe some university money.
So there the university had to sell the idea to the government?
That's right. That's right.
Okay.
So the university managed to sell this idea, and the machine finally worked.
And hopefully it did what it was designed.
It did work. It did work. And so that was 59 to, well, say 67, something like that.
So how long did it take for the build the construction of the cyclotron?
Oh, it took about, let's see, started 59. It was, we had the conference in 65, so okay. 59 to 64, 5 years, something
and
like
you
that.
You were in charge of this whole process.
I was in charge of building the machine.
So that meant you had to deal with all the contractors or the...
Yeah, that's right. We managed to hire two engineers that were helpful and looked after a lot of these things, but I was sort of in charge of the whole thing.
So did you have any other responsibilities at that time, teaching or anything?
Not really. They released me from teaching.
Okay.
on the grounds that I was needed to build the cyclotron.
Okay.
So that was so. And that went on. And... okay, so I went to University of Grenoble, Grenoble.
When was that?
In France.
Yeah, when?
What?
When?
In 1967-68.
Uh-huh.
So because they were building a cyclotron that was the sort of, I think it was a bit higher energy, I can't remember.
So in order to get the higher energy, what, you use higher magnetic fields?
A bigger machine.
Bigger.
Yeah,
radio.
It was bigger. And the idea was that I should do experiments on the machine, but it never worked while I was there.
I see. So that was...
It didn't work until later.
You had a lot of didn't work experiences in your...
That's right, right. It didn't work.
So I guess that explains this period from like 1958 to the mid, actually, 62 or 67 when you didn't have any publications. You were involved so much with the cyclotron.
Yeah, I was involved with the cyclotron.
So there was no time to do research or to do any publications.
Although I think there were some publications that don't appear in here.
Okay.
Because this was mainly for succeeding things.
Uh-huh.
There were some publications, but nothing very important.
Okay. Because I looked at their publication record from SciFinder, and there's this, you know, this period where there's just nothing happening, and I was kind of...
Yeah, that's right, I was in charge of building the cyclotron.
Yeah, you were a manager.
Yes,
so
that's
so
right.
Speak.
Anyway, I went to Grenoble in 67-68, and the machine didn't work while I was there.
So what did you do?
Well, I did various things. We had lived up in peripheral town called Saint-Saëns, and I ran off a cliff. And completely clobbered the car that we had. But fortunately, not me.
Oh, wow.
I was okay. It was up in the mountains, you see, small mountains, but big enough that it could clobber the car.
So this was obviously an accident of some kind.
Pardon?
It was an accident. You were driving too fast for the road, or you missed a car?
I was driving... Well, I'd lent the car to somebody, and he'd complained that the accelerator and the brake were too close together.
Oh.
And I think this was the problem. I hit the accelerator when I should have hit the brake.
Okay.
Anyway, it rolled over three times and finally ended up with a tree, next to a tree, but fortunately didn't burn or anything.
Yeah.
And I was okay. So anyway, to deal with physics, I didn't do very much at that time. I tried to keep my hand in.
Sure.
They had a staff to build the cyclotron, so there wasn't any opportunity to contribute to the design.
Uh-huh.
And as I say, it didn't work while I was there.
Yeah,
so
that's unfortunate.
It didn't work till later on.
Now, these trips, by this time you're married, I assume.
Pardon?
You were married by this time. You'd gotten married?
I'd married and had three children by that time.
Okay.
So we rented a house up in this place called Seysin, this outlying town.
So you had your family there?
I had the family there.
That's good.
And, okay. And then there was a strike in France.
Okay.
A grève.
What's the name of that? They call it?
G-R-E-V-E is a French word for strike.
T-R-E-V-E.
I think there's a circumflex in there somewhere.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And so that shut down the lab and shut us down pretty well.
Yeah.
So I put the family on a plane in Geneva to travel to England, and I drove the car from Grenoble to Cherbourg and caught the last ferry from Cherbourg to England during the strike. And the strike didn't end for some time.
Really? So that pretty well... So you ended up in England. What did you do then? You
just This was a month or two before the term started back here, and I did a little bit of work on the gamma ray scattering that was still going on. Okay, then I came back as director of the cyclotron in 68.
Can't get away from that cyclotron.
What?
Can't get away from that cyclotron.
That's right, that's right. I was still a nuclear physicist. I hadn't yet learned the joys of mass spectrometry. So I was director of the cyclotron, and that involved me in, if people came in with a problem, I was sort of expected to look after it. And among other things that it aroused my interest in biology, first of all.
Because of the people coming in?
Well, people came in. First of all, there was an experiment producing nitrogen-13 for tracers, and then...
This would be tracers in a metabolic...
Tracers, tracers in, with somebody, Norm Campbell in microbiology. And then a proposal for analysis of the Canadian grain crop for protein content.
Uh-huh. Okay. So this is a fairly highly specific problem.
This was a specific problem that had been there was an outfit called the Grain Research Lab in Winnipeg that was doing this.
Okay.
And doing it by the so-called Kjeldahl method.
Okay. How do you spell that?
K-J-E-L...
D-A-H-L?
D-A-H-L.
Yeah, Kjeldahl. Okay, sure.
Yeah, he was a Dane, I think.
This is a chemical.
And that involved treating... You put the sample into a... a test tube of some kind, a container, you added acid and looked at the ammonia that was produced. So this was very time consuming, and I know I never saw this, but the Grain Research Lab evidently had a whole bank of these glass vessels that were analyzing for nitrogen.
Uh-huh. Why were they interested in nitrogen?
What?
Why were they interested in nitrogen?
Well, they were interested in nitrogen because that determines the protein content.
Okay.
And the protein content of grain is very important for Canada because this determines the baking quality. So the Canadian grain crop was sold largely on the basis of high protein content.
I see.
And, okay, so they had the banks of Kjeldahl. Are you comfortable?
Well, I'm trying to get squared away, so I'm at an angle with respect to the. Let me see if I can get around this way.
We can move the desk around if you want to.
This works much better because I can.
All right.
Square onto this. Keep
all right. Anyway, they had these banks of Kjeldahl apparati down at the Grain Research Lab, and the search was on for a better way of doing this. And some people had used nuclear methods for doing it already. For example, I think the most... the main thing that had been used was... the nitrogen 14 end-to-end reaction on giving nitrogen 15.
Okay.
And then you counted the positrons from nitrogen 15, there was then a positron emitter, and you counted the positrons, the annihilation radiation from the nitrogen 15.
Okay.
But the trouble was that this was very non-specific. If you bombard almost anything with proteins or nitrogen or neutrons, you produce positrons.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if you tried to look at the annihilation radiation, so-called, the 500 kilovolt radiation that two photons are given off when the positron decays.
Mm-hmm.
This was non-specific.
Okay. So it gave you some measure, but it didn't really tell you what you wanted to know.
That's right. It was if there was background, if there was impurity of some sort in the grain, it might detect that as well as
okay.
as well as the nitrogen.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so I had going way back before I arrived in Princeton. There had been some experiments that were done partly by Ruby, Schur, Meether, and White.
Schur, Meether?
S-H-E-R-R, Meether, M-U-E-T-H-E-R,
and White. Okay.
That had been looking at the radioactivity of carbon 10 and oxygen 14.
Okay, carbon 10. Carbon 10.
Yeah.
Carbon 10. That's
well, the that's well, never mind the carbon 10. The oxygen 14 had the favorable property that it had a nearly all the decays went to an excited state at 2.3 MeV. So, this was finally specific for detection of nitrogen. This was the reaction we were using was simply PN on nitrogen 14, which gave oxygen 14.
I see, okay.
So the idea was you'd measure the oxygen 14 and that gave you a measure of the, or you measure this gamma ray and that gave you a measure of the nitrogen content, which was normally interpreted as the protein content of the grain. Okay. Okay, one problem was that the lifetime of oxygen 14 was only 70 odd seconds.
That's not too long.
What?
Not too long.
Not too long. So what we did, by this time I had a postdoc who was interested in, I guess I was replaced as cyclotron director by in 74, roughly. So I was free to do follow my own interests. And I got interested in this, and I had a postdoc, Don Doan, who was interested in it. And we developed an apparatus to do this using the O14 activity. So we had a conveyor belt. We irradiated the sample in by the cyclotron, and we brought the sample then through the shielding wall on a conveyor belt and put it in front of a pair of big scintillation counters and measured the activity.
Okay.
So, and the activity as measured then would tell you what the nitrogen content was of the grain.
And that would be specific to the protein.
That and that was 2.3 MeV is a rather definitive sort of energy. So this was definitive for the... and, okay, and we worked on this. And the exciting thing was that Don Doan, who had been working with me on it, had come to the end of his period, and I think he got a job at Argonne.
Argonne National Lab, right?
What?
Argonne National Labs.
Yes. Yeah. And so I'd hired a guy named by the name of Brian Chiat.
Yeah. So that's where he came from.
That's where he came from, who was then at Oxford. And was interested in doing things that had a practical impact rather than just a nuclear physics impact.
So Brian started out as a nuclear physicist.
He was a nuclear physicist as well. He'd done a he'd come from South Africa to Oxford and done a thesis on nuclear physics at Oxford.
Okay.
So that's where Brian arose.
Interesting.
And, okay.
He came here.
What?
He came to the University of Manitoba.
Then he came to the I was able to attract him to the University of Manitoba because he was interested in doing things that had a practical import.
Okay, very good.
And so he had accepted a job at U of Man.
Okay.
As a postdoc. Okay. Well, things had gone on in the lab that analyzed for the Canadian grain crop, the, what do you call it again, the grain research lab.
Okay.
And the head of that, that I didn't have anything to do with, had been under a good deal of pressure to say, to solve this problem, because he had this great bank of Keldahl apparati.
Yeah.
And so he got up and made a speech to something or other that said, we have the solution to this. It's measuring the infrared reflectance of the grain.
Oh, okay.
Now, that we had various objections to that. We knew about the technique. But anyway, this was a solution that they had adopted at the grain research lab, and of course they were the judge of these things, so they weren't able to tell how accurate it was. But anyway, our funding for this project dried up at that stage, and this is more or less when Brian was in transit, I think, or maybe shortly after he arrived. And so we'd got interested in biological problems, and in particular we'd become we'd realized that you didn't only want to know the protein content of a grain or a biological sample, but you wanted to know a number of other things. You wanted to know what the structure was and so on. And at that stage, I consulted Bob Barber, who was a member of the other Harry Duckworth group in the department. And he said, why don't you go down and talk to Ron McFarland?
Okay.
So I had, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, I had met Ron already. I knew him. And I'd phoned him up, and he was happy to, by that time he'd moved to Texas A&M with the one, with Dave Torgerson. And so that was the idea that we might build a plasmid PDMS machine. Okay, so we're getting closer to mass spectrometry. Finally.
Yeah. Well, I mean, your career started out as a physicist.
It started out as a nuclear physicist. Yeah.
And you're doing nuclear physics and building cyclotrons and doing all this other stuff.
Yeah.
But somehow you got sucked into this grain problem.
That aroused my interest in biological questions, I guess. So then I went down and visited Juan McFarlane in Texas A&M. And he was very kind to us.
What year would that be when you went down to see McFarlane?
That's about 70, late 70s.
Okay.
Late 70s. And we decided then to build a PDMS machine.
Okay.
And we managed to get about $5,000 from graduate studies to do this. By this time, I wasn't in charge of the cyclotron anymore, so I'd lost that source of funding. But we were foolish enough to say we were going to build a PDMS machine.
It's $5,000.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we started off, and or at least Brian started off, and designing the machine, which you can see if you interested.
Yeah, I'd like to look at it.
It's just a pipe. So we did that, intending to build a PDMS machine with fission fragments. And we got so far, far enough along to order a californium source. And by this time, Brian had, first of all, Benninghoven had done experiments where he'd measured
he was doing surface.
He'd measured the mass spectra from peptides. Relatively small things. And the question was whether we could do something similar, but at much higher energy. Much higher mass. So Brian looked up and found a way of making low-energy ions. Benninghoven hadn't been able to do very large molecules because he'd been using mass spectrometers that were only capable of dealing with large masses.
Large energies?
Quadrupoles. He was using quadrupoles, and they were limited in mass range.
Right, okay.
So anyway, it was a gamble, but we decided it was a gamble worth taking. Okay. We got so far as to order a Californium source, and in fact deposited it up at Pinawa, where Dave Torgerson was by that time.
Okay, what's the name of that place, Pinawa?
What?
Pinawa is, how do you spell it?
It's in Manitoba. P-I-N-A-W-A.
Okay, that was the place to keep it safe.
To keep it safe.
Okay.
To keep the californium safe.
Yes.
We never did
do that,
get it back. Anyway, one advantage of that was that by that time Dave Torgerson had gone to Pinawa, and so he was available to advise us. Okay, so
carry on. I'm fine.
We decided to go ahead and build the spectrometer using cesium ions.
Okay. This would be a surface analysis kind of thing?
What?
For surface analysis?
No, for protein analysis.
Oh, okay.
Basically.
Okay.
And with the hope of getting seeing large molecules as McFarlane had seen by PDMS, but Benninghoven had not been able to see because of the limitations of his spectrometer.
Okay.
But we were using a time-of-flight machine similar to Ron McFarlane's.
Right.
So we didn't have that drawback.
Right, okay.
So we started, and I guess the first thing we really, first effort we really proposed was at a conference in at Orsay.
All right.
Well, it was actually at the Institute Curie in 1980. We'd started to build this machine in 79, and by 1980 this is the 27th conference in Seattle of ASMS.
Okay. All right. So it's
you can
like
turn
a,
over.
It's kind of like a fab experiment, isn't it, in a way.
We'd managed to analyze potassium iodide.
We got to start somewhere.
Yeah. Anyway, we went on, and
hang on, let me put some information in here, and then I'll. This was, and which year was this? ASMS.
That was the 27th conference in Seattle in 79.
Okay. Let me just get the page number here, and I have all these on as PDF files, so I can get that.
Yeah. And so by that time, we progressed a bit beyond potassium iodide, and we were able to, I think at that stage, we reported a comparison between fission fragment desorption and cesium ion desorption.
Okay.
If not, we proposed this at Benninghoven's meeting, which was later that summer.
Uh-huh.
Benninghoven had a meeting in, which was EFOS 1, never published.
EFOS 1.
IFOS 1.
Okay.
There was a whole series of EFOS meetings.
EFOS meetings, okay.
Yeah. Anyway, that was EFOS 1 that was, we submitted a paper, but they never got, Benninghoven never got around to publishing it. EFOS 2 was that fall, I think.
Uh-huh.
And was in fact published. And by that time, we had progressed a bit beyond, we progressed to organic materials.
So you're beginning to stretch this technique a little bit, pushing it harder to heavier compounds.
Well, I don't know that we pushed it harder. We looked at different samples.
Just to see how it worked.
What?
Just to see how it worked.
Yeah, to see if we could do large molecules.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well,
so,
I don't know.
So we finally arrived at mass spectrometry.
Yeah, so this is in 1980, where you turned out.
It's the 79 to 80, yeah,
okay.
Yeah, we.
Very good. Well, why don't we take a break then?
All right.
And maybe we can relax a bit and grab lunch. What do you say?
Yeah, let's see, what's the time?